Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Coming up on the broadcast today, why it's okay to hate all those meetings you have to go to, how the mortgage business is changing, and what performance art and the economy have in common. You're going to want to hear that one. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Tuesday, the 24th of September. Great to have you with us, everybody. Forget debt limit and budget and defunding and Obamacare, because Case and Shiller are the economic buzzwords of this Tuesday. Their latest benchmark report on home prices came out this morning. Prices are up in each of the 20 cities that get measured, but the rate of increase in those prices is slowing, perhaps because interest rates are also on the rise. Not good news for buyers and not good news for lenders. Citigroup just announced it's laid off 1,000 people, all from its mortgage division. And in fact, some of the rest of the country's biggest banks are trimming their mortgage operations as well. Marketplace's David Weinberg reports there are big changes in the world of mortgage banking.
If you go back about 20 years and look at mortgage applications, you'll find that the vast majority, 80%, were new home purchase loans, and the rest were refinances. Today, it's nearly the opposite. Only about 30% of all mortgage applications are new purchase loans.
We've had this prolonged refinancing boom because mortgage rates just continued to hit new lows. They kept hitting new lows. And a lot of people were refinancing over and over again.
Greg McBride is a senior analyst with Bankrate. The result of the refinancing boom was that banks hired more employees, and over time, their mortgage divisions generated a larger part of the bank's profits.
Think of it like a seesaw in the respect that when rates are really low, refinancing activity takes off.
And now that interest rates are rising, the demand for refinancing is dropping, says Jed Kolko, chief economist at Trulia.
And typically, when you have a mortgage rate spike of half a point in a month, which is a big increase, but that's what we've had in May and June, refinancings tend to drop by almost half.
So what does all this mean for the housing market? Well, for homeowners, it means that refinancing will save them less. For banks, it means they'll be looking for ways to make up for that decline in revenue from their mortgage divisions.
I expect we're going to see some banks start increasing their home purchase lending, making it easier than it has been to get a mortgage for people who are looking to buy a home.
And according to the new Case-Shiller report, that home will cost about 2% more than it did last month. I'm David Weinberg from Marketplace.
The geopolitical action this week is in New York. The UN General Assembly is in session. There was no face-to-face meeting between President Obama and Iranian President Hassan Rouhani, as had been rumored. The two countries have had icy relations for decades now, as you know. But Iran is on a charm offensive, in part because that country's economy has been hit hard by U.S. sanctions. Those sanctions include trade embargoes that prevent many Iranian companies from doing business here in the United States. And companies that try can have their assets seized. Marketplace's Noel King looked into what happens after the seizure.
Just last week, a federal judge said the U.S. government can seize a 36-story Manhattan skyscraper. The Fifth Avenue building is partly owned by a company called the ASA Corporation. The judge said ASA is a front for an Iranian bank. Charles Intriago is president of the Association of Certified Financial Crime Specialists. He says all kinds of assets can be seized. Then usually the U.S. Marshals are brought in to watch over them, or sometimes they contract the work out.
You know, there have been racehorses seized, for example. Then, you know, the marshals may not know much about keeping thoroughbred racehorses, but they will hire, the government will hire some folks to make sure that those thoroughbred racehorses are maintained in top condition. A building, too.
Like that one on Fifth Avenue. The owners may appeal, and the U.S. government will have to prove their ties to Iran. But shouldn't companies with links to the Iranian government know better than to do business in the U.S.? Patrick Clausen is with the Washington Institute for Near East Policy.
Look, I mean, there have been some stunning bank accounts when you have to go, what did these idiots, what was crossing their minds when they opened that bank account? People aren't very bright.
Clausen knows about these bank accounts because he's got a side job. He serves as an expert witness in the court cases of Americans who are suing Iran. These are victims of terror attacks that Iran has had some part in. So think of the Marines who were hurt and killed during the bombing in Beirut in 1983. Since the mid-90s, the U.S. government has allowed them to sue to get some part of the billions of dollars of seized Iranian assets. Clausen says increasingly,
the courts have ordered that the banks to hand that money over to these victims of Iranian-sponsored terrorism, who have now collected hundreds of millions of dollars, and the Iranian government is not happy about this process.
Which means it's one more way for the U.S. to keep the pressure on Iran. I'm Noel King for Marketplace.
Housing was up. A lot of prices on Wall Street were down today. We will have the details when we do the numbers. There's going to be a meeting in Washington this week that could be a big deal for the airline passenger public. An FAA advisory committee is going to finalize rules for when we can use electronics on airplanes. Expectations are that the rules are going to be relaxed, which could be, depending on how you think about it, both a blessing and a curse. Farhad Manju covers technology for the Wall Street Journal. Farhad, good to have you with us.
Hey, good to be here.
Can we now say, to quote the New York Times, that mass travel has met mass communications possibly?
Yeah, possibly. I mean, and thankfully, I mean, it took so long for this very sensible change to happen. So hopefully we will soon be able to use the internet, use our devices as we do everywhere else.
Why has it taken so long?
You know, there were for a long time, I think there were these safety fears, but they weren't really proven. There was no evidence for them in many of the studies that had been done.
How much of this has been occasioned, do you suppose, by the fact that we now have live television on airplanes? We now have Wi-Fi, even though it's spotty and really expensive. I mean, we've got all this stuff.
You know, I used to think about the plane as kind of a break from all of the other stuff that we have going on. It was this place that where, you know, I used to get a print newspaper before I got on a plane because that was the only thing you kind of, you know, you were allowed to do. Now I think of it as working time, especially now that we have internet on the plane. I can do a lot of work on there, and I can't anymore kind of justify those 10 minutes or whatever that, you know, I just have to sit there and kind of not do anything.
Okay, but is it a good thing that it's work time now for you, or is it a bad thing?
Well, it depends on who you ask, right?
Well, I'm asking good
for,
you.
It's good for my boss.
That's right.
You know, I think it's good. You know, I live in California. I often have to fly to the East Coast. And if I can't do any work on that flight, it's a whole day. It's a whole work day gone. I mean, I think that you could argue that it's making us more productive. I think you could also argue that it's, you know, eating up into any kind of leisure time that we used to have. I think some people kind of looked forward to the plane because that would be the one time where they wouldn't have to, like, respond to their furious emails from their bosses or colleagues. They could credibly claim an excuse for that, and now you can't.
Farhad Manju, he covers technology for the Wall Street Journal. Farhad, thanks a bunch.
Hey, thanks.
Facebook is experimenting with a new service. It's called Autofill with Facebook, which I think we can all agree won't win any branding awards, but which is part of the hottest concept in making money online. Frictionless payment is what it's called, as in making it easy as possible for us to buy something without thinking about it too much. In the Facebook example, if you want to buy something in an app, instead of having to enter all your info for the umpteenth time, you just log in with Facebook, which, of course, already has all your info, and zap, transaction completed. Right now, Facebook's only got a couple of partners, but as Marketplace's Queen of Kim reports, once you get started, it's a slippery slope in the very best e-commerce kind of way.
The big online retailers have gotten us so used to frictionless payments, it's worth remembering what it used to be like. Rebecca Lieb is an analyst with the Altimeter Group. She says in the early days, before eBay bought PayPal,
when you purchased something on eBay, you then had to navigate over to PayPal, sign into your PayPal account, find the auction that you just won.
If you're tuning out right now, imagine how the shopper felt. eBay eventually bought PayPal, and now everything's just a couple clicks away. Amazon and iTunes are also masters of the frictionless payment.
They make transactions faster and easier, and also more impulsive.
Tell me about it. I look at half the songs I downloaded from iTunes, and I'm like, where'd that come from? And then I remember that party where everybody's like, hey, do you have that song? And I'm like, sure, click. Brian Yeager's an analyst at eMarketer. He says Facebook and Twitter would love to bring that mindless buying behavior to social media.
They're trying to attract more advertisers to their platform. They want to be able to prove that somebody sees an advertisement within a few clicks, they can have a very seamless path to purchase.
Yeager says Facebook and Twitter are a long way off. But he says if they can master that is, make it easy to click an ad and buy on a mobile device, that will give them a huge advantage over print and TV with advertisers. In San Francisco, I'm Queen Akim for Marketplace.
Coming up,
discover how the 10K rule must be followed in order to have affiliate success.
What? I know, total non sequitur, right? Stick around. We'll make it make sense. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial shed 66 points today, about 0.4%, closed at 15,334. The NASDAQ eked out a two-point gain, less than 0.1%, 37.68 at the bell. The S&P 500 down 4 points. That's 0.25%, ended things at 1697. Housing stocks were a bright spot today. Lennar and KB Home were both up more than 4%. That after strong earnings reports this morning. Rough waters out there for Carnival Cruise Lines. Its ships have suffered some high-profile mechanical problems earlier this year, as you know. And the company said today that future bookings were down. So, too, were shares in Carnival, off almost 8%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.65%. And you? Wait, what's the name of the show? Oh, yeah, you're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at Marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at Marketplace.org/the Big Book.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Senate Special Committee on Aging discusses the changing retirement landscape for baby boomers. The Commerce Department reports on construction of new homes for August. And your supermarket may have already tipped you off to this one. September is National Chicken Month. So many recipes, so little time. And then you have to share. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. We've all been in them. We've dreaded them, to be honest. The worst part of office life, if you ask me, the meeting. But you know what? That's okay, because it turns out maybe a lot of those meetings are useless. Time is money, right, people? Nancy Kane teaches at the Harvard Business School. She joins us from time to time. Nancy, good to talk to you again.
Always a pleasure, Kai.
You are preaching to the choir here, sister, about this meeting thing, man. I have never met a meeting I don't hate.
Yeah, bad meetings, they're like endemic. Every time you mention a meeting to someone and the cost of bad meetings, people's eyes light up.
Well, lay it out for me, the numbers of how many and how much wasted time and money and all this.
All right. So our best estimates, and these are pretty educated, mm-hmm. are there are 11 million formal meetings every day in the United States.
Man.
That tallies up to about $4 billion a year. Over half of the people surveyed say that about half the meetings they attend are unproductive. So maybe a little more than 2 billion meetings a year that most people regard as, you know, a very poor use of their time, that yeah. seems like a real waste.
Why do we keep doing it then?
Well, that's a great question. I think part of it is, you know, routine. Habit.
Yeah. Yep.
I think in a strange way, email has actually unleashed our inner, you know, meeting demons.
Really?
Because it's so easy to, you know, hit list serve
oh, yeah.
and ask 15 people to a gathering whether there's really a good reason for the gathering, whether you need all 15 people, whether you could accomplish that goal some other way. We just hit send and off it goes.
So give me some solutions. I had a boss in the Navy once who only had 15-minute meetings and he only had them standing up.
So that's really interesting. I'll bet yeah. you folks got a lot done.
Bang, 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 baby.
Yeah. You know, Samuel Johnson, the great 18th century yeah. essayist once said that nothing so focuses a man's thoughts like the prospect of hanging. And I think that meetings
okay,
are very much—
Okay, that's a little drastic, but anyway.
Okay, but meetings are a little bit like that. If they begin on time, if they end on time, if people know you only have a short amount of time to get a stated goal completed, the odds are much higher that people will actually do that, that conversation will be productive, that the right people will chip in. So I think part of it is too many meetings that run habitually late, that start late, that now with our, you know, addictions to our smartphones also now have this little siren song next to us all the time saying, if this is boring, I think I'll just check out.
Were you looking over my shoulder at our editorial meeting this morning?
Exactly.
Nancy Kane at the Harvard Business School. Thanks, Nancy.
My pleasure.
We're going to be hearing a lot about Obamacare this week, what it can do, what it can't do, what it's going to cost, and who's going to pay for it. Health insurance exchanges will be up and running in a lot of states on Tuesday, the 1st of October. Today, we're going to bring you a story that starts at the doctor's office, where instead of just asking you to talk about the pain in your foot or the ache in your chest, doctors are starting to ask people about their stories, the idea being that social and psychological conditions like poverty or chronic stress can be bad for your long-term health. A warning before we get going, if the kids are nearby, parts of this story aren't for everybody. From the Health Desk at WHYY, here's Dan Gorenstein.
It's the kind of thing she kept buried inside herself.
Some things you don't expose. It's a judgmental world.
But here was 30-year-old Elizabeth Philkill telling nurse Renee Murray, a virtual stranger, that she had been sexually abused for years as a child. It was something she told only two other people in her entire life. One night, a few months ago, a dream threw Philkill back to those days, and she wanted to forget fast, so she phoned a friend.
I called to get me some wet, and I made it through it. Bam.
Nurse Murray, who runs a program for underserved pregnant women in Camden, knew what the drug wet could do.
Wet is marijuana with PCP dipped in formaldehyde, and you smoke it, and you're not on our earth anymore when you're high on wet.
Philkill was 3 months pregnant at the time. Outwardly, Murray didn't react to the fact that Philkill had endangered her baby. She wanted Philkill to feel safe, to keep talking. It's something Murray had been trained in earlier this year, something called motivational interviewing, a way of getting patients to open up.
I was thinking, like, yeah, it's crazy. This is someone's pregnant, doing this drug that you hear all these horror stories about. But now here's Elizabeth as a nurse. My job is to sit here and to learn Elizabeth's story. Because if I don't learn her story, I can't do my job.
It worked.
She'll know me from a can of paint. And, like, she cared, like, a little bit more than people that should care cares. So it made me get out what maybe I didn't want to expose. You know what I'm saying? Like, it made me go deep in as to, you know, why did you smoke wet?
In Camden and around the country, this listening technique, really a first step in changing behavior, is catching on because it's seen as a way to help treat patients who are tough to reach, patients like Philkill. But here's the big idea. Researchers are coming to see that the prolonged chronic stress that comes with worrying about food, safety, and money can make people sick. British epidemiologist Michael Marmot says people who suffer from chronic, sometimes called toxic stress, are more susceptible to chronic disease and early death.
What's only come to light over the last decade or so is if a child is exposed to a stressful environment, an abusive environment, that affects brain structures. That can actually change the architecture of the central nervous system.
And Marmot says this can happen to anyone, young or old, poor or rich, if they feel a sense of helplessness.
Where the threat is uncontrollable, I mean, you're threatened by a wild animal, you run away from the wild animal, you escape, but then you recover. That's what's supposed to happen. But imagine you can't get away from this wild animal. It never actually tears you apart. It's just threatening you all the time.
Marmot is primarily concerned with the physiological effects from long-term threats. Princeton psychologist Eldar Shafir, who co-wrote the book Scarcity, is looking at more immediate stresses, particularly economic ones. He says money trouble, and especially poverty, takes away your ability to think about anything other than what's right in front of you.
You know, the rent this month is questionable. The dinner for the kids is not yet taken care of. Those sorts of financial impositions take a load on your mind that leave less mind for other things you need to handle.
Like going to the doctor and taking your medicine. This is particularly important for people with chronic conditions that demand constant attention, like diabetes and heart disease. That small fraction of patients who are responsible for the majority of all spending costs. Medicare thinks the connection between trauma and chronic illness is worth exploring and has invested nearly $20 million in a three-year, four-state project based on a model designed by Dr. Alan Glasrow from Stanford.
This work begins by asking the question, why wouldn't a person with a chronic condition do everything in their power to live long and feel well? And generally, there's sort of a subtext, which is, what's wrong with this person? They're not listening to me.
At his clinic, Glasrov sees 160 privately insured patients who on average racked up $58,000 a year in medical bills before he began treating them. Glasrov directs his team to focus first on what matters to the patient, like dancing at his daughter's wedding, then deal with the fact that the patient is diabetic and smokes three packs a day. Glasrov says his approach has helped shave 20% off his patients' medical costs.
If we succeed at this across the four states, it'll be a huge step forward.
It's the kind of step nurse Renee Murray is trying to take with Elizabeth Philkill back in Camden.
When you're dealing with people that have complex issues, if they're not ready to get the care they need or to make a behavior change, it's not going to happen. This approach gets them a little bit closer because now there's a healthcare provider who is showing a genuine interest in their life.
But Murray's a realist. She knows Philkill's life is rocky. She's got no job, no permanent place to live. Since her talk with Murray, Philkill's disappeared from prenatal class for weeks at a time, had her phone turned off, and continues to smoke cigarettes. That said, she did show up for class this week. In Camden, New Jersey, I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
The other stories in Dan's series, Diagnosis Camden, are online at marketplace.org. I'm going to level with you here and tell you that this next part, well, it's going to get a little weird. It's about performance art and corporate America, Twitter, and self-help books as well. Horse underscore ebooks is a Twitter feed with 214,000 followers. For 4 years, it's been tweeting out bits of seemingly random advice. But then again, 214,000 people followed it, so there had to be something there. Speculation had been that it was a spam bot, completely automated, just Twitter spam. But it turns out there were real people behind it, one of whom is Thomas Bender, who spent the day bringing horse underscore ebooks to life at the Fitzroy Gallery down in Lower Manhattan. We got him mid-performance. Thomas, it's good to talk to you.
Good to be here.
The only way I can think to start this interview, Thomas, is what the heck is this horse ebooks thing?
Horse ebooks is a conceptual art piece created by Jacob Bacala. He has manually tweeted short spam fragments roughly every 2 hours for the past several years.
And these are, I mean, when you say short and spam, it's nonsensical stuff.
Well, I think it depends how you look at it. I think some people okay. have arguably found more meaning in it than in humans' tweets.
Has this been basically sort of stealth marketing all leading up to this gallery thing you guys are doing today? I mean, this is an art installation.
Right. So we're doing a performance today for today only called Bravo Spam.
And it's you and Jacob sitting there answering the phone. You tweeted out a phone number and people call it, right?
That's correct. So the phones have been ringing nonstop since 10 a.m.
I should say we tried, actually, and it was busy.
You weren't able to get through?
No.
Yeah, so there's been a, you know, we're answering the phones as fast as we can and delivering short spam messages, and they're ringing off the hook. You can probably hear it in the background.
So I'll tell you, there's a video clip of you guys online in the gallery answering the phones, and it does look a little bit like office automatons sitting there, you know, mindlessly answering the phone. I can kind of get the vibe.
Right. I mean, I think with several of the things we're doing, if you saw it or observed it casually without looking closely, it could pass for a real business. And we like this concept of business art and performing through businesses.
Do you have some of the text there that you've been reading to the phone callers?
Would you like me to read a couple of these entries?
I would, very much.
Discover how the 10K rule must be followed in order to have affiliate success.
Oh.
Post-interview.
Oh.
Banana nut cake.
I don't know what that means.
The ebook. Garaging business plan. Online music retail business plan. Quicker recovery time from injuries. So, I mean, they're very hopeful and positive, I think.
I guess bit by bit, you could see some philosophy coming there.
Right. I mean, I almost wonder, these fragments might be more valuable than the actual self-help books they're taken from.
Thomas Bender, he is with Jacob Bacala, the creator of Horse eBooks, the Twitter feed that is all the rage online today. Thomas, thanks a bunch.
Thanks very much.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out today, which A, gets us to the political news of the day, and B, appeals to the history geek in me. Today is the 96th anniversary of the Second Liberty Bond Act, which in 1917 helped finance the American entry into World War I. $3.8 billion worth, by the way, at a yield of 4%, but that's not the important part. You know what else was in the Second Liberty Bond Act of 1917? The first ever federal debt limit. See what I did there? All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM. Nancy Fargali, John Ketchum, and Jolie Myers are the producers on our Marketplace desks. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you back here tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.